I'm really pleased to welcome our next guest to Closing Argument. Daniel Pipes is the president of the Middle East Forum. Welcome to Closing Argument, Daniel.
Thank you, Steve.
I wanted to deal with something that you wrote in one of your blogs in the past that resonated for me, particularly this week in view of the mass murder that occurred in that Aurora, Colorado theater. And you wrote the following: authors and artists cannot control how their work is received, who will respond to it, or what purposes it will be put. And of course, we look now at the fact that there was this Batman movie, The Dark Knight Rises, I should say. We can't blame the movie maker for the influence of that movie on the killer, can we, Daniel?
No, you can't. It's meant as entertainment. What you're quoting of mine was published just about a year ago, because exactly a year ago was the atrocity in Norway, when Anders Breivik killed 77 people. And it was a very, very strange thing for me, as well as an awful one, because I'm used to watching killers be people with whom I have nothing at all in common intellectually, who are Nazis, who are communists, who are Islamists. But Breivik has something in common with me. Now, that said, it's also pretty clear from looking at him that he has a lot not in common with me, that he wants to hurt someone like me. But it was a sobering moment. It's not happened before, and it's certainly not happened since, that someone with any kind of parallel to my own way of thinking would engage in an atrocity like this, mass murder.
Breivik was apparently motivated by hostility to the multicultural policies that he believed led his country, Norway, down the path to Islamization. Am I right about that, Daniel?
That's right. Yep. Well put.
And you had to deal with the fact that Breivik had cited you in his manifesto. Am I also right about that?
Yes, he did, many times.
And publications such as Time, The Guardian, Le Devoir attempted to place at least some of the blame on you for this terrible atrocity. Am I right about that, too?
Yeah, what happened is that a left-wing American think tank called Think Progress did a quick and dirty graphic on the citations of what it called right-wing pundits and organizations cited in Breivik's manifesto. And Robert Spencer was there, Bachi Orr, I was number three, and others. And the effect of this graphic was to cause anyone who wanted to attack them and me to say, aha, here are the sources. In fact, if you look more closely, you see that he cited some 1,600 people, and he cited pretty much as many on the left as on the right, as many Muslims as those who criticize Islam or Islamism. So it was a distortion. Unfortunately, it was a distortion that took, and I've had to battle it ever since. In fact, I just came out today with a piece on the anniversary, going into great detail, looking at the leftists, the Muslims, the Christians, the historical figures, the writers, and others. But yeah, I was mentioned often. If you take the whole manifesto, I was ninth most commonly mentioned, right after the Muslim prophet Muhammad, tied with Geert Wilders and Osama bin Laden, and right ahead of Karl Marx.
I can only imagine what a disturbing moment it must have been when you discovered that. But let's just give some perspective to this, because some of the people that he named, and I did my research on this, included Madonna, Karl Marx, Nelson Mandela, and Winston Churchill. And no one's going to point to any of those people and say they're to blame for the terrible massacre in Norway, nor should you be blamed because he cited your manifesto either. That's simply my view, and I want to make it clear where I stand on the issue, Daniel.
Thank you. Yes, I obviously agree with you. Jesus Christ was third most commonly mentioned. Charles Martel was fifth. A Muslim figure by the name of Anwar Shaban was sixth. Hitler was seventh. There's a lot of Marxists like George Lukács, Theodor Adorno, Herbert Marcuse, Antonio Gramsci. Yeah, a lot of people. But it shows what the power of the press can be. You get something out fast, and you just it's not, you don't give inaccurate information, but you give distorted information, and then the impression is created.
Daniel, you wrote in one of your blogs that the disconnect between Breivik's mainstream political conservatism and his psychological derangement presented a new dilemma and challenge for conservative thinkers like you. What did you mean by that?
Well, in that there was a great deal that I would agree with in what he wrote and said, but obviously, you know, vehemently, totally disagree with his methods. I'm used to disagreeing with people who I have, who I'm on the same team with. This is something that one does all the time. You don't have total alliance on every issue, but to have psychological derangement of this sort mixed with many sensible views, this is something that was shocking and remained shocking a year later. I'm still trying to figure out how to account for this.
The ruling in the trial of Anders Breivik will come later in August, but the trial really turned into political theater. It was really an opportunity for Breivik to espouse his views. His lawyers are fighting this insanity verdict that the prosecutors are seeking to find, which is really unusual, I must say, as a defense lawyer. You're trying to argue that your client is indeed sane. What's your view of the trial as you watch this as an interested observer, Daniel?
Well, as you said, it was highly unusual. Breivik was trying to turn it into a political theater, into a political trial. He was trying to hurt specifically those individuals and organizations who he broadly agrees with. I mean, it's rather bizarre. Like the blogger who goes by the name of Fjordman, or Bruce Bauer, an American who lives in Norway, and others, he was trying to implicate them and say, look, these are my friends. These are the people who I agree with. I'm part of a movement. Of course, they were doing their very best, and they succeeded in not being defense witnesses. It was an upside down trial, but isn't that what happens when you have a political motivation rather than a criminal motivation?
Daniel, if you were living in Norway, I would expect they would have tried to bring you into the case. Bruce Bauer's misfortune is that he was a literary critic living in Oslo, Norway, and he was drawn into the case. Did he ultimately testify? Can you tell our listeners how, in fact, that turned out?
No, he did not. And indeed, my organization was involved in trying to help him to stay out of it. I saw him some months ago in the United States, and he said, you know, how good it feels not to be in Norway, that he's not afraid here of a knock on the door in the middle of the night and the police coming, which I don't think did happen to him, but he was certainly afraid of it. There's a very tense mood there there's a very hostile attitude if you are critical. If you have anything in common with Breivik's outlook, you paid heavily for his actions, which was, I repeat, an intention, an intended consequence of his mass murder.
He did, let's be clear, also, you describe you as a moderate at one point in his manifesto, so that should be noted as well.
Yeah, and it wasn't meant as a compliment either.
No, but at least he was distancing himself from you. It's interesting. I was reading a column in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, and there's some criticism about not just simply the Norway has allowed this trial to unfold, but also about the penalty that ultimately faces Breivik if he's found guilty. He's looking at a maximum sentence, as I understand, of 21 years under Norwegian law, and that he can have a friend of the court. Friend to sit with him, I should say, during part of his detention, so he won't be alone. Am I right about that?
Yeah, the 21 years is the most astonishing thing. I mean, here he's gone off and killed 77 innocent people, and he can be put away for just 21 years. Well, at the same time, it was also made clear that various administrative procedures could keep him in for the whole of his life. But, okay, that's fine. But nonetheless, the symbolism of having a 21-year sentence for mass murder of 77 people, that points to Europe and the way it's gone. And it wants everybody to get along and doesn't want to have any penalties. And it's a very, from an American perspective, a very strange environment.
Yeah, and you've pointed this out about the possibility he can actually serve longer than 21 years. can possibly renew his detention, I should say, if found that he's a public danger. So the potential is that if he's found guilty, he can still spend the rest of his life in a Norwegian prison, right?
One assumes that, yeah. When you, it is very difficult to imagine that he would be let go,
how is this case
even in Norway.
How is this case being received in Norway itself, Daniel?
Well, it was seized upon by the critics of the critics, by the critics of people like Fjordman and Bruce Bauer, to discredit them. Say, aha, here is the proof. This is what your thinking leads to. And in a lesser form, the same thing happened in the United States to those of us who were cited. Aha, you know, this is where it goes. And so we were, you know, we had to defend ourselves, which is not a pleasant thing to have to do, and say, no. Look at all the differences, look at the criticisms, look at, you know, that he is in many ways a Nazi, look at his derangements, look at his no sense of heading the Knights Templar, you know, none of this has anything to do with us. But they did seize this opportunity to try to discredit us.
All right, we're going to take a break shortly, Daniel. When we come back, I want to ask you about your views about the American policy of releasing prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, because I know you have very sharp opinions about that topic.
You're listening to Closing Arguments with legal analyst Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And we're back with Daniel Pipes. Daniel, you've written about what you describe as the incautious policy of the United States government of releasing prisoners from Guantanamo Bay. It's your view that anyone detained in Guantanamo Bay should be kept there indefinitely. Am I right about that?
I can't say every single one, but the record shows that these really are dangerous and violent figures. And since the releases began in 2004, 3 years after they were first taken in, the released prisoners have gone on to all sorts of criminality and terrorism, violence of different sorts, and the number has just steadily grown. The most recent case, of course, is the Bulgarian case, where a released Guantanamo prisoner by the name of Mehdi Ghazali is the one who killed 5 Israelis and a Bulgarian in his attack last week. But he puts a face on this, but he's far from the first one. The figures I show that 60% of the released Guantanamo detainees have definitely returned to terrorism, and 12% are suspected of having done so. So that's a grand total of about 28% who have returned to terrorism. That is a very big number.
But Daniel, the Obama administration must be aware of the same statistics, in fact, as you are. Is it just recklessness on their part that they're releasing these people, or they've just decided, look, we have to make a decision at some point that we can't keep these people indefinitely?
Well, to be fair, it was under the Bush administration that this began, 2004, and most of, by far the largest number, something like 75-80%, I would say, were released by the Bush administration. And it was already evident back then that this was happening. And the Bush administration continued, and the Obama administration stepped it up in the sense that it was committed on coming to office almost 4 years ago to close down Guantanamo, which has not happened, but it was really trying to get people out the door. Yeah, and that has, that commitment to closing down Guantanamo trumps these cases of terrorism, violence. Maybe the very high-profile nature of the Burgos attack on the 19th of July will lead to a shift, but I don't know. I mean, it's dismaying to see. And by the way, the Israelis have done similarly. The Israelis have had larger numbers. They've released at times up to 1,300 prisoners in exchange for one or two or three as live or dead Israelis. And, for example, in 1985, we have a good perspective on that, it's over a quarter of a century ago, over 1,100 prisoners were released, and of those who released the West Bank and Gaza, 48% resumed their terrorist activities, and yet they still do it. In their case, it's a little different in that it's soldiers that they're getting back, not civilians. In their case, it's a little different. There's a deal being made, whereas in Guantanamo, there's no deal. But these numbers are terrible. And the most recent release was for Gilad Shalit just a few months ago, and already a number of those released detainees are back engaging in violence. And yet, it goes on. It's been going on now since the 1980s. And I can't understand why either the Israeli or American governments are doing this. Again, the Israeli government understand a little bit in that it's a trade, but it's such a lopsided trade of 1,100 live prisoners for a few bodies. It's a sentimental policy rather than a strategic policy.
All right. Well, Daniel, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on Closing Argument. I'd like to invite you back again in a future program.